You are listening to the best of Consider This, put together over the last few years of this show. Well, good morning and welcome back to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark.
I'm Sherry Kantos.
Happy to have you guys along. Thanks for all of the questions and the comments. Please keep them coming. Consider this at yourlifeafterwork.com. We do our best to try to bring out the things that should matter the most in your lives financially and that can really make a change. Mm-hmm. One of those is understanding how tax-free money really works. So If you were in the office, I would show you what I call my candy wrapper model to try to make sure that people understand their investments. So Sherry, there's four things as a fiduciary, and that's my job. By law, I have to treat your money as if it were my money and we were in the same situation.
Right.
Okay. So there are four things that preoccupy my mind. And if you're acting as your own fiduciary, if you're managing your own money, these four need to be at the top of your radar.
Okay. Right?
One of them is risk and volatility. And understand what those two mean. The second are fees and expenses. Keep in mind they are different. Fees and expenses are different things, but it's something that erodes your return if it's not watched out.
Sure.
The third is taxes, but that's both today and tomorrow, what we're going to have to pay in the future years going down the road. And then last but not least is real return. That means I've got to get something above zero plus whatever the inflation rate is so that I'm not eroding purchasing power.
Right.
Now, how do you watch those four things? Well, there are three things that you can really invest in: stocks, bonds, and cash, right? Those pretty much the only three. If I put it all in stocks, I'm going to have a lot of volatility.
Yeah.
But historically, I haven't had to worry about the real return because the market outpaces inflation.
Okay.
If I put it all in cash, I'm not going to have to worry about volatility.
Right.
Right. But I'm going to get eaten alive by the erosion of my purchasing power with inflation.
Right. Right.
So my job as a money manager, as a registered investment advisor, is to help you have the right mixture of candy based on where you are in the financial world today. Stocks, bonds, and cash. Right.
Sure.
Now, most places use a wrapper that goes around those stocks, bonds, and cash. When you go to the store to get candy, there's usually a wrapper around it. If you're at a good restaurant, there's usually a wrapper around it. Mm-hmm. You don't want other people's fingers on it. And the wrapper that most people use inside of the financial world are mutual funds.
Yeah.
We tend to prefer exchange-traded funds. They're much more tax efficient and they're cheaper, which is why I like them as much as I do.
Right.
Anything that costs fees and expenses, we want to cut and curtail every time that we possibly can. So I show you this on a board because I want you to understand mutual funds and exchange traded funds don't have returns. The candy, the stocks, bonds, and cash, that's where the return comes from. All the mutual fund is a tool to hold those investments together for you.
Right.
Now, there may be another wrapper on the outside of this, and that's where you get into the tax wrapper. And it could be an IRA, it could be a 401k, if you're a teacher or nurse or doc, it could be a 403b, and it may or may not have a Roth option. Now, Sherry, a Roth option's real simple. A Roth is a money where we decide we're gonna pay taxes today, right? Remember, because you're looking at taxes both today and tomorrow. We're going to pay taxes today, but we never have to pay taxes on the growth of our money when we go to pull it out, assuming we follow all of the rules, right?
Right.
So having tax-free money is very, very good. So, you know, somebody came in to see me just a couple weeks ago. Maybe it was just last week now. Came in to see me and had $25,000 sitting in a savings account that they had for the last 5 or 6 years. And I looked at their tax return and their income was below $183,000 married filing jointly, right? Which means they're eligible, if they have earned income, to contribute to a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. In this case, they had earned income of about $90,000. They had $25,000 in savings. And they had no Roth IRA. And I looked at them and I said, why don't we have a Roth IRA? And their answer was, well, our advisor never told us we could have a Roth IRA. And I said, well, you've got $25,000. And the wife said, no, we need that for emergency savings. You know, we don't want to invest that. And I go, I totally get that. But remember, a Roth is not an investment. Mm-mm. It is a tax code. right?
Right.
It's a tax code. You can decide which of that candy that you want, the stocks, the bonds, or the cash, or a mixture of the three. Said, you need to go to your bank. You don't have to give me the money, but you need to go to the bank and tell them, in their case, they were over 50, so they were eligible to put $6,500 a year into a Roth IRA. So you can go to the bank. If you want to keep it in cash at in a CD or something for an emergency, that's fine. But put $6,500 in each of your names, so, you know, $13,000 worth, into Roth IRAs. Make that money tax-free forever.
So did they actually physically have to move it out of that savings account into two separate accounts?
Absolutely. The account needs to be titled as a Roth IRA
into both of them, 65-65. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there's no reason
not to do that.
Remember, with a Roth contribution, you have access anytime you need it or want it to the money that you put in.
Right.
Now, that doesn't get you around market volatility.
No.
But remember, a Roth is not an investment. You choose whether you want to use stocks, bonds, and cash. If you want to leave it, if it's just been sitting in a bank for six years doing nothing, there's no reason not to make it tax-free. Now, this is where it's hard for me to understand why people don't immediately get this concept.
But,
these are bright people. And the husband looked at the wife and said, well, honey, it didn't make that big of a difference because the interest rate we're getting at the bank is so low, it doesn't matter. That is a really, really bad way to look at this. Bottom line is you could have had the whole $25,000 tax-free. So now let's say you make another $25,000 next year
right.
in a different investment. And you decide that you want to make that a Roth, right? You've got $25,000 worth of money in a Roth. You know, you can easily use the cash that you've got from the new place. You know, you can make as a savings account if you want to, and then invest the money that's inside of the Roth. You just can't go back and make up for those years, is what I'm trying
right.
to
say. Right. Yeah.
But you've got to think about, you know, the tools that are in your chest and where you're going. Mm-hmm. Right. So. And again, I told you the rules in the last time. Don't talk to somebody who's selling something that only has one tool in a box to use.
Right.
Don't talk to somebody who doesn't ask to see your tax return. Right. And you know, just don't ever do it. So we just moved some money over. People heard us here on the radio and had money with the mutual fund store. And they had advised her because she didn't have a 401k at work. That she should be putting money into an IRA, but they didn't see her tax return, right?
Yeah.
So she comes in and we sit down and I look at the tax return. They make too much money to be able to contribute to a Roth IRA. You know, it's above the $183,000. So they can't contribute to the Roth IRA. She already has an IRA. So every dollar that they were having her put into her IRA, it was going under a non-deductible side. If you have a husband and wife, one of them covered by a retirement plan at $98,000 of income, you're no longer eligible to take that as a deductible IRA. So she was putting money into savings. That's a good thing. Into her IRA and with what we would call basis. It's money that she's already paid taxes on.
Right. Right? Okay.
So it's continuing to grow tax deferred, but it's not getting near as much benefit for her is someplace where she may be able to get tax deferral if that's what she wants. And so, again, the advisor at the store, you know, said, hey, put the money inside of your IRA. He didn't know that she was above the AGI limit, right? Because he didn't see the return.
Yeah.
She didn't know what that number was.
Sure.
Right? CPA doesn't get stuff until March.
Right.
And then just merely reports, it just shows on there that, you know, okay, you've got basis. So nobody's looking at all of this together. And when I sit down, if you have earned income in the United States and you're under 70 years old, under 70 and a half, and you're eligible to contribute money to a non-deductible IRA, just as she was doing.
Right.
That's just the way the rules are. It doesn't matter if you make $1 million a year, you're eligible to put $5,500 a year if you're under 50, $6,500 a year if you're over 50 into a non-deductible IRA, assuming you're under 70 and you have earned income. That's on line 7 of your 1040. It just means you made something.
Right.
If you're the only one that has earned income in your household, you can still contribute to your spouse's IRA. So in my case, you know, Barb is a stay-at-home mom. I could put money in an IRA for her, and I could put money in an IRA for me. And for the record, we do. We do take advantage of this. So when I sit down and I looked at this family's information, I said, okay, you have an IRA. You're above the limitation to be able to contribute to an IRA, but you're for
a Roth.
Deductible IRA, you're above for a deductible IRA, and you're above for a Roth.
Yeah.
However, your husband doesn't have an IRA. Right? Your husband doesn't have an IRA. So what we're going to do is open up an IRA for him. Instead of you putting money in an account for you, we're going to put the money in the account for him and make it a non-deductible IRA. So we put the money in, and this is exactly what I do for me every year, right?
Okay.
We put the money into the non-deductible IRA. We wait 30 days so that we have a statement that shows, yes, there was a contribution that was made. And then we roll it or convert it. So it's not a contribution now. It's a conversion from that non-deductible IRA. You've already paid all the taxes on that money.
Mm-hmm.
But we convert it into a Roth IRA, right?
Wow.
Now, it's not like a contribution where you can go get the money right back out of it if you need it. There's some five-year rules and age 59 and a half. But it is a wonderful savings vehicle. And now we're building a tax-free component inside of the investment world, if you will.
Wow.
So a couple things to get out of this segment that really matter. Understand that it was between a Roth contribution. That's putting in money this year based on earned income this year and following the requirements. And a Roth conversion, which is based on looking at money that was already in an IRA of some nature that you wanted to say, okay, IRS, please tax me. And you know, we'll pay the taxes today. No penalty. We'll pay the taxes today. But I want to convert it to a Roth so all of the future growth is tax-free.
Right.
And think about what you just did, right?
Yeah.
I put money in a non-deductible IRA, right? So that, I mean, it was after-tax money. It could have been in that joint savings account. It could have been, you know, it doesn't have to be money that you actually made this year. You just had to have earned income to be able to qualify to do it, right?
Is there a limit on the amount you can convert?
Yeah, no, you can convert $1 billion if you have
really?
To have it.
Absolutely. So you can only put in $6,500 a year, but on you can convert.
But you can convert your entire 401k.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
That's a whole nother story. We'll get into it.
I know.
Time, but
yeah.
Understand these rules. And I'm telling you, I've been in this industry for 28 years. Stock markets go up and down. You send the IRS a check, the money
does not
come back, right? It just does not come back. If all conversations do not start with your 1040, you are missing a large part of the financial obligation of securing your retirement future. There is nothing that will separate you from your retirement like the IRS. Just nothing.
Nope.
Hey, got to take a break. We'll be right back. You are listening to the best of Consider This, put together over the last few years of this show. You know, I've been in the radio, newspaper writing business not quite as long as I've been a financial planner.
Not quite, but
this is year 29 in the industry, and it's over 21 years for radio and for newspapers and things like that. So I've got to meet a lot of people in the industry. One of the gentlemen that I will tell you this, when I write the column for the Herald Bulletin that gets picked up in a lot of places, and you can find it on our website at yourlifeafterwork.com, one of the challenges is you have 500 words, and
right.
Then you're done.
And only 500.
One of the challenges I have on radio is I have 9 minutes. And then we take a break, and sure. Then we get to do it again. So you can't cover everything. But Jason wrote an article that said, hey, in his opinion, and he does a pretty good job, in his opinion, these are the 19 things that you should ask your financial advisor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't disagree. I think he left. I think he – I disagreed with two of the questions.
Really?
And I think he left one out. But go ahead. Sherry,
okay.
You can start.
Are we going to go through all 19 or just the
10? Hopefully we'll get them done.
All right. Number one, are you always – a fiduciary, and will you state that in writing?
Absolutely. It's everywhere on our website. Totally agree, Jason, with that. It is my job legally to treat your money as if it were my money and we were in the same situation. We sell nothing.
Okay. Number two, does anybody ever pay you to advise me? And if so, do you earn more to recommend certain products and services?
No, we do everything in-house. So my CFA, my chartered market technician are both on the team. We do not get paid a dime by TD Ameritrade, which is where we custody our money.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody has any ability to influence us. And in fact, My CFA, Adam Harder, is going to get to go to the New York to be on the stock exchange and ring the opening bell.
No way.
And a company is offered to pay the flight and the housing and all of that. That may sound okay in your world. It is not okay in ours.
Wow.
Well, he is certainly going, but we are writing the check.
Good for you, well, by the way.
Rules are rules.
Yeah. Number three, do you participate in any sales contests or award programs creating incentives?
None.
I figured.
You have to sell products to be able to do that. We're totally independent. So yes, do we have, do we celebrate with our team? Is it paid for by our team? Yes. We don't do that with anyone else.
Okay. Will you itemize all your fees and expenses in writing? That's a big one.
And I don't even know where that came from, because if you're fiduciary, that has to be there.
It has to happen. I know, but
it's in our ADV part two, and it's very, very clear. And all of our returns, anytime we show them to anybody, are net of all fees and expenses.
Okay, so, but let me ask you this, Joe Average Public, is it going to be understandable?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So sometimes it's not. Sometimes
There's a neat little application called Hemingway that I use for my newspaper articles to make sure that sentences are clear and understandable and what grade level is required to be able to read it.
That's
and
cool.
We use that for a lot of different things.
Okay. Are your fees negotiable?
No. They are one should go above $3 million. I have to treat you and my mother and anybody who's listening to this the exact same way.
I think that's good.
I can do it for free, or I can charge the fee that
you
is based
everybody.
On the assets that you have. And I think that's the way that it ought to be.
Can fiduciaries negotiate? Is that even an issue?
There are some fiduciaries who will negotiate on that rate based on services they provide.
Okay.
We take care of people who don't want to worry about their money.
Right.
And so here's the service that we provide. We use the fiduciary focus. And so we help people with risk and volatility, making sure fees and expenses are controlled and contained, the taxes both today and tomorrow, because you're on a journey, and making sure that inflation doesn't eat your lunch. You get a real return.
Okay. So this is kind of a related question. Will you consider charging by the hour?
No. And that's a fair question to ask somebody if that's what you need. There are 24 people on the team at the Financial Enhancement Group. I certainly can't do it alone. And when you work on an hourly rate, you're doing it based on what you're doing. And I don't do anything based on me. I do it based on a team that requires a lot of other people.
Sure, right.
The hourly rate would be incomprehensible.
Crazy. Yeah, I understand. That makes sense, actually. Can you tell me about your conflicts of interest?
Everybody has a natural bias and built-in conflicts of interest. Mine are that we get paid to manage money, and so I would rather the money be here than elsewhere. That can be a conflict. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, but I certainly do have a bias, and that would be the conflict that was there. Other than that, as a fiduciary, I have no bias. My job is to treat your money as if it were mine and we were in the same situation.
Okay, so this is kind of a redundant question. Do you earn fees as an advisor to a private fund or other investments that you may recommend?
No.
No, you already said that.
We charge everything that we do is, as registered investment advisors, we charge the families that we serve a fee, regardless of where the assets are, for the management part.
Okay. Do you pay referral fees to generate new clients?
No. When you look at the referral fee, I have partnerships with several accounting firms and accountants.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard me talk about that before. They are part of our business, so that's not a referral fee. It's a partnership interest.
Right. 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 Okay. And I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you focus solely on investment management, or do you also advise on taxes, estates, and retirement?
Yeah, we're tax junkies here. We believe in five critical elements, five areas where people can get into trouble. Your life after work is our version of retirement planning. Then the tax planning that has to be done every year before the end of the year. Third's the investment playbook. That's how your money is managed. Fourth is the things that happen in life, the good, bad, and ugly. And then fifth, of course, is the legacy plan. We incorporate all of that into our planning every year.
Okay. Do you earn fees for referring clients to specialists like estate attorneys or insurance?
No.
I figured not.
We don't take them and we don't pay them.
You don't want them. Okay. Oh, wow. What is your investment philosophy?
Yeah. And I think that's a really good question to understand where it is. We take care of people who don't want to worry about their money.
Right.
Our vision in terms of the industry is we believe everybody is entitled, should be entitled to a professional fiduciary. And then our mission, how we do that within the industry, is to take care of people who don't want to worry about their money. That means we're not trying to hit home runs. We're trying to get a lot of singles and score runs.
Do you believe in technical analysis or market timing?
Yeah, and this is where I got really frustrated with Jason.
Mm-hmm.
Our chartered market technician is Andrew Thrasher. He was one of my students at Purdue. Yeah. He's the youngest award winner of the Charles Dow Award in history. Mm. Technical analysis was actually here before fundamental. Mm. Right? Do I believe in market timing? No, that's silly.
So why does he combine those two?
I don't know. And I actually did respond to him because he said, "Hey, tell me if you think I missed any." And I've not heard back from him yet. Huh. But I would disagree with that, and I would put that more under the philosophy of what is your investment philosophy is where that ought to belong. Okay. You know, I do the macroeconomics, the narrative, as we call it. Adam, our CFA, does the fundamental part, and then Andrew does the technical part. All three have to be in line, in my opinion, to make a wise decision.
Okay. Do you believe you can beat the market?
No.
Okay.
It's not even a goal.
All right. I know.
You know, when I'm in the hospital, you know, I think I was in seventh grade, and the nurse looked at me and said, "Mr. Clark, you're not a very good patient." And I said, "Ma'am, it's not even a goal. I want out."
I
would tell you the same thing for trying to beat the market.
That's funny.
We're trying to protect people's resources, and I'm much more worried about the tax implications than I am trying to squeeze out another 0.5%.
I love it. Okay. We got to hurry here. How often do you trade?
He put in there, it shouldn't be more than once or twice a year. And I wrote back, I said, "Jason, we trade no more than what we have to,
right?
But as often as necessary, right?
Yeah.
So I had Adam pull our numbers. Right now, the average holding in our portfolio has been there for 2.3 years with the median 0.95 years. And that's because since the Trump election, there was a lot of major changes, and we had positions we'd held for 3 and 4 years where we had to make some changes.
Right. Okay. How do you report investment performance?
This is going to have to be the last one, Sherry, we actually have a statement. When we provide the statement, it shows since you were here. So we bought the technology at the end of 08. We show what your return has been each of the 5 last years individually. More importantly, we show it collectively over that journey since you've been a family at the Financial Enhancement Group. We do not believe in snapshots. Don't think it's good for people. But Jason, I appreciate you writing the article. You did not in there address business model, which is the one that I told you in my suggestion you should add. I think that is critical. If you don't know the business model, you don't know how they're going to be able to provide the services that they promised to provide us.
Right.
Hey, you can shoot me an email. Consider this at yourlifeafterwork.com. We'll take a break and be right back. You are listening to the best of Consider This, put together over the last few years of this show. I told Sherry that we were going to have to be done with Jason's article, but there are 3 questions that are left that I think are important enough that we're going to have to continue. If you missed the last segment, Jason Zweig writes for the Wall Street Journal. I think he does a good job in a lot of reporting and a lot of information. He wrote an article and said, "Hey, here's the questions that you should ask your financial advisor." Mm-hmm. If you missed that, I gave the answers on the first segment of today's show. You can always get a replay of that either on iTunes, Consider This with Big Joe Clark, or on our website at yourlifeafterwork.com. So go ahead, Sherry, 3 more questions.
Okay, so which professional credentials do you have and what are their requirements?
Yeah, so I'm a board-certified financial planner. That means I had to have education, have more than 3 years of experience, and then pass the board exam to be able to have that. Adam Harder is our CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst, and Andrew Thrasher is our chartered market technician. All 3 of those, and Don Hodson's an enrolled agent. All 4 of those require ongoing continuing education that has to be done every year.
Wow.
I happen to be on the board of the Financial Planning Association in Indianapolis, where I just spoke and provided continuing education. Get a kick out of this. I don't get any continuing education.
You don't get any for providing teaching it.
I thought that was a hoot, but anyhow, we do, you know, that's the answer.
That's funny. After inflation, taxes, and fees, what is a reasonable estimated return on my portfolio over the long haul?
Now, see, this is where I believe this becomes so, so critical. When we talk about the phases of finance, the accumulation, preservation, and distribution, think about being on a big airplane. And when you get on an airplane, to you as a passenger, there's not a lot that changes over the course of that flight. You hopefully land safely where you want to go, right? But the pilot and the crew do amazingly different things. And so I realized that people look at their investment statements the same, regardless of what age they are. And folks, that's really a mistake. When we're younger and accumulating money, when we're saving the money and starting to build our net worth, if you will, the 2 things that matter the most are saving the right percentage of your income. The national average right now is about 3.8%. It probably needs to be higher than that for you if you're going to have a good retirement. And secondly, those building tax diversification. That means you have some money that is available to you. It's what we call taxable. Mm-hmm. You have some money that is tax-free. That's the Roth. And money that is tax deferred, you know, you may have in a 401k or other types of IRAs. Preservation is when you get to the 30,000 feet and the plane levels off. That's when you're still saving, but it's also when you're able to get more coffee and do things like that. So at the preservation stage, you're still saving, but what you've already accumulated matters more than what you're adding this year, right?
Right.
It usually happens to people in their 50s and 60s, not necessarily using the money, but letting it grow.
Right.
The key here is that's the only time an average return really matters. Mm. And what we see in most of the stuff that we do for a balanced type investor,
yep,
that average return tends to be between 6 and 8% over the long haul.
Mm.
That changes when you go to land the plane,
right,
or in distribution. In distribution, the two things that matter the most are volatility, the ups and downs of the account, what we would call the drawdown. And the second one is the taxes that you pay on the average dollar that you pull out. To look at your money and an average return, or what Jason called the long haul,
mm-hmm,
in preservation is fine. It is not fine in distribution.
Right.
Volatility matters more, and you have to be very, very careful there. Mm-hmm. He suggested somewhere between 3 and 4%
right,
is what you should expect.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that in distribution. I think it's underperforming if you're in preservation. You know, but just understand those are two very different cycles.
Yeah. Okay. Last question. Who manages your money?
Adam, Andrew, and myself.
So same people.
I'm not allowed. Legally I'm allowed. I just ethically don't think that I should be allowed to have my money in places where I don't keep other people's money. So my money is the same place, my in-laws, the same place as my, my mother, the same place as my, you know, my stepfather.
Yeah.
The families that we serve, we believe that it is all together, and that's the way that it should be taken care of.
Okay.
Now, the one last thing that I said that Jason didn't put in there is I would always ask the business model before I started working with a company.
Yes, and why?
A business model's not how you get paid.
Right.
A business model is how does this work? Why does it matter?
Right.
And
yeah.
And I think it is very critical. People many times have the bestest of intentions.
Right.
Right. And, you know, my grandfather taught me years ago, the smallest deed outweighs the grandest intention.
Right.
Right. So
yeah,
when I started in the industry 29 years ago, I had every intention of seeing you every year and providing a family update and doing everything. But the bottom line is, Sherry, I had to feed my family.
Right.
And a new person, because 29 years ago, I sold things.
Right. Right. Yeah.
A new person coming in offered me a lot more income than somebody who was already there.
Sure.
Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so once you'd already said yes, you kind of felt, not because I wanted to.
But you had to feed your family.
I had to feed my family.
Sure.
I had the best of intentions, right?
Right, oh, yeah.
And I know there's a lot of people out there that are in the same boat. They have the best of intentions, if you will.
Mm.
Well, you know, 29 years later, you know, the Financial Enhancement Group's 20 years old this year. We built the model around the service model. And quite frankly, an existing family, somebody who's already been with us, who's coming in for a family update,
right,
is worth more than the new family coming in. Now, it's always exciting to meet new people.
Sure.
You guys
call off
the radio every week, and whether it's Grant or Aaron or Dean or myself, you know, we love meeting you, sitting down, answering questions. We love watching the family at the Financial Enhancement Group grow. Don't take it that way. We're more than happy to be of service.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who's already been here, the paperwork's already done, right? They're already familiar with what a market carver is.
Right.
They already know why our statements are so different than the rest of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
They know that I'm a tax junkie,
mm-hmm,
right? They've been through that process. And as we talked about in the last segment, their fee is the same as the new person's.
Oh,
right.
Yeah,
so the model
.
Is built, uh-huh, you know, so that there's actually a bias toward people who've
already
been here.
Oh, that's good.
As opposed to the new side.
Yeah.
You know, there was a family last week that wanted to see me. I wanted to see them. One of my widows had an emergency, and they're going to come first.
Wow.
And so we had to change the date of the meeting, and I apologize for the frustration, but you know, that's what you do for family. And that's really the way it is. I know we've got a couple other questions that came from Investopedia, so just go ahead. Yep.
Okay, so what are the pros and cons of a minor opening a mutual fund account?
Yeah, so forget the mutual fund part. That's a product, right? We know it's a wrapper.
Yeah, we don't do that. Yeah.
Let's think about it as a minor account. So there's a couple different ones that you can use. UPMA, Uniform Minors to Transfer Act, UGMA, Uniform Gift to Minors Act.
What's a minor, though? Can we first say that?
A minor is either somebody under 21 or under 18, depends on whether it's stated. And what state that they're in. Over 18, you have to be to legally sign a contract.
Right, that's what I thought.
But every now and then, I will see somebody who opens up an account for a minor and then puts money into it. And I will always tell you to have a little bit of caution. You've got to watch out from a tax standpoint of a thing called the kiddie tax on investment income. But the real challenge is at either 18 or 21, they become the legal controllers of that money.
Right?
And you may have wanted to put the money in for them to be able to have a house down payment or to pay for a wedding or pay for college. Mm. And they may want to go to Disney World. You know, they may have an idea of a sports car as opposed to the ideas that you had intended with the money. So you've got to be careful. I tend to, and I just did this last week, we opened up an account. The parent was concerned about the in-law, in other words, the one that's married to her child.
Yes.
And as a result, we left it in mom's name and put it a thing called TOD, which just stands for transferable upon death. Yes. That way, if mom wants to give him money or her money, she can. At the same time, the assets are protected in case there were to be a marital challenge.
Mm.
Hey, we got to take a break. You're listening to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark, along with Sherry Kontos. Shoot me an email. Consider This at yourlifeafterwork.com. You are listening to the best of Consider This, put together over the last few years of this show. I know what I want to do on what I call my free days. You know, so the life of an entrepreneur, and if you're a business owner listening to this, that you probably qualify, but the life of an entrepreneur is almost always filled with some thought of the baby, of the business, especially if you build it.
Yes.
You know, I was fortunate enough to be a co-founder of the Financial Enhancement Group. And so it has been my love and my dream. And, you know, I joined a coaching program called Strategic Coach, which is based in Toronto, by the way. I go to Chicago for it.
Yeah.
It's a 3-year program.
Uh-huh.
This is my 17th year. Some may
Wait
say
a minute, 17th year in the program.
I'm a flunky, apparently.
Oh.
I always learn so much from the other entrepreneurs that are there and the coaching and the thought process. And I'm just so appreciative of what it has taught me and what it has done. But my point of all of this is it taught me a time system of where I have days that are very, very focused, like the days I do the radio and the days that I'm doing strategic planning with the families that we serve or somebody on my team. There are buffer days where I have messes that I have to clean up, things that only I can do as the managing partner and, you know, those kind of things. And then there's free days where I don't have any contact at all with what's going on in the business. And my definition of a good free day is when I do something new, meet somebody new, or see something. I love to travel, you know, museums, things like that. So what's the point, Joe? Well, one of those things on a free day is to do stuff that is maybe repetitive, but with friends and family where you're ingraining that memory, right? I will never forget growing up at this little lake cottage on Grassy Creek Channel. We were there every Memorial Day, every Labor Day with 25 or 30 cousins in a place that had no hot water heater.
Yeah.
And you took showers in the lake.
In the lake.
It's where I proposed to my wife. And I will always adore those memories. So what does this have to do with money? Well, it has to do in our industry. You'll hear a lot of people talk about estate planning. And at the Financial Enhancement Group, what you're going to hear us talk about is legacy planning, because legacy to me is a lot more than just money. You know, I have families who come to me who have lots of wealth, and I have families who come to me who are trying to figure out how to make retirement work, and pretty much everywhere in between, right?
Right.
And not all of them have a taxable estate. Some do. Some have more than $10 million that we help, but not everybody has a taxable estate. They still have a legacy to pass on, whether it is stories of Uncle Johnny in World War II, whether it is, you know, why we started the company business and how it got sold, mm-hmm. whether it's why half your family all went into teaching, you know, whatever the story is, that is part of your legacy.
Right.
So my coach, a strategic coach, Lee Brower, came up with a Brower quadrant, and here's how he teaches people estate planning via the concept of a legacy. And I agree with it so much, but you know, that we all have our core values and beliefs. Now, you know, Sherry, you and I have talked about it. We're dramatically different in terms of some of our beliefs that we carry and hold that our parents did.
Right. Yeah.
We outgrew it, mm-hmm. or we adapted. Doesn't happen in every family. That's a different thing.
Right.
And we're allowed to do that, but right. that still doesn't mean that we don't have those memories that we etched, you in Canada, mm-hmm. me at the lake place.
Right. Right. Yeah.
That we need to make sure that we keep in mind what those core values are. We have talents that we were all given. I, for some reason or another, understand the world of finance. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my unique abilities is taking very complex financial things and breaking them down in a simple way so that hopefully you have the ability to understand it.
Hopefully.
I don't care who you are listening to the show. I don't care what it is you think you did as a profession. God gave you a unique ability and a talent that you thrive at. And, I was talking to a young man, you know, I got in the coaching program 17 years ago. And mm-hmm. I'm 50 now, right? So, I'm talking to one of these guys that's only been in for 4 years, and he is just having a heck of a time.
Aww.
Because things keep breaking at his house,
uh-huh.
and his wife expects him to be able to fix it. And he expects himself to be able to fix it because his new bride expects him to be able to fix it.
That's
right?
not in his
because
will.
Her dad could fix anything.
Oh, wow.
Right. So
that's tough.
You know, and you know, this that's is why tough. We get together. It's why you share these stories.
Yeah,
you know, my father-in-law, Ed Burt, mechanical engineer, can fix anything and will do anything for anyone, whether it's the church or Barb and I. And it took Barb and I probably a year for her to understand I can fix anything.
With a phone book,
right? God did not equip me with that talent, but sharing those stories, this part of a legacy that you really want to share and pass down. So the financial part of it obviously is gaining assets, and then you have the documenting part. And the documenting part, in my mind, is critical. So many people, when they hear the word estate planning, think it's a check off item. You check it off, and it's done. It's 2017. If you knew the number of trusts that I see that were written without a two in front of them, it would baffle you, right? So people did them. The earliest one I've seen here this year, I think, was 1983.
Wow.
I can't tell you the number of tax code changes.
Yeah,
I can't tell
you
the number of life changes, right? I've seen them with beneficiaries where the beneficiary is no longer alive.
Yeah,
It's something that needs to be done. So our process in here, we cover what we call the five critical elements in every time we sit down and do a family update. And we start off with that financial vision. And if you're not one of our families, or if you're trying to do this on your own, it's fine, but just pay attention to these categories. First, you want a written stated financial vision. For us, that's a couple sentences long. It's not quantitative. It doesn't have a number. It has with here's who I am and here's what it is that I'm trying to accomplish, right? And then there's five areas where we feel your retirement and your financial side can really go awry, right? Your life after work, which some people would call retirement. We don't really see that happen. Most people don't watch grass grow. They find something to do,
right,
either for compensation or for volunteer work. Second is tax planning. Remember, it's got to be done every year. The third is the investment playbook. We do have to pay attention to a changing economy and market. Fourth are the things that are odd, that are good, bad, and ugly, but are usually one-offs in our life. But that last is that legacy planning. And every 3 years, we believe documents need to be reviewed and updated. So we do a tertiary, a courtesy review every year to make sure all the beneficiaries are alive, all the people are still there, no new grandkids, no new assets, no new inheritance, stuff that needs to be jiggled or juggled around. But every 3 years, we try to restate the documents. That's just part of our process and something we think you need to consider. Please don't have a 10-year-old trust and think it works. Tax codes have changed. in many, many fashions. Hey, you're listening to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark, along with Sherry Kontos. Email us your questions. Consider this at yourlifeafterwork.com.